At 4:30 p.m. on March 30th, 2002, Israeli military forces took over Palestinian TV stations when they occupied Ramallah in the West Bank, immediately shutting them down. What followed was a little more unusual. Shortly after occupying the Al-Watan TV station, the Israeli forces began broadcasting pornography over its transmitter. Eventually, the Israelis expanded their cultural offensive against the Palestinian people by broadcasting pornography over two other Palestinian stations, the Amwaj and the Al-Sharaq channels. One 52-year-old Palestinian mother of three children, according to this report, complained about the deliberate psychological damage caused by these broadcasts. The only Palestinian station not taken over by the Israelis ran a message at the bottom of its screen claiming that anything shown on Al-Watan and other local TV channels has nothing to do with Palestinian programs, but is being broadcast by the Israeli occupation forces. We urge parents to take precautions. Why in the world, asked one woman, would they do such a thing? Today I'd like to answer that lady's question. Why did the Israelis broadcast pornography over Palestinian TV stations? Before I can answer that question, I need to give the official explanation, the official American explanation. According to that explanation, pornography means freedom. This explanation is put forth in The People versus Larry Flint, a big budget Hollywood movie promoting Hollywood's connection to the pornography industry. This film was produced as part of the pro-pornography propaganda that got produced when Congress was debating the Communications Decency Act in the early 1990s, an act which was supposed to ban obscenity from the internet. So according to the contemporary Hollywood explanation, the Israeli troops began broadcasting pornography over captured Palestinian TV stations because they wanted to spread freedom among the Palestinian people. Somehow that doesn't sound right. The simple fact of the matter is that this incident cannot be explained according to the principles available in contemporary American culture. In order to understand the disparity between the official explanation of pornography and what might be termed its military use, we have to go back to the ancients. The story of Samson and Delilah is a good place to start. Except for the fact that the roles are reversed in that story. Go ahead. Israel was invincible militarily. So the Philistines decided that they had to get at the Israelite leader by other than military means. Unable to defeat Samson in battle, the Philistines decided to seduce him sexually. Once Samson succumbed to Delilah's wiles, he lost his power, and Israel lost its leader. They could find him not on the field of battle, but rather, to use Milton's phrase, eyeless in Gaza, grinding at the mill with slaves. Having learned their lesson, the Israelis decided to turn their tables on their opponents because they knew that a blind opponent is no opponent at all. And because they knew, as the ancients on the northern side of the Mediterranean, the Greeks, knew as well that lust makes a man blind. St. Thomas Aquinas gives expression to the same tradition 1,000 years later when he says, lust darkens the mind. A man without a mind is not a formidable opponent. Therefore, lust can be used as a weapon to render an opponent blind or irrational and therefore incapable of mounting a coherent counterattack. At this point, we are beginning to see the outline of why the Israelis were interested in broadcasting pornography. It wasn't because they were interested in promoting freedom. It was because they were interested in promoting freedom's opposite, namely bondage or slavery, because slaves, especially people who are the slaves of their own passions, do not make good fighters. The ancients' explanation of how sexual passion could be put to military use is not all that different than a report issued by the Palestinians 3 months before this incident happened. On January 12, 2002, the Islamic Association for Palestine news agency ran an article claiming that representatives of the Central Intelligence Agency and the Israeli Shin Bet, the experts there have recommended that the relatively conservative Palestinian society be flooded with pornography, drugs, and gambling in order to keep Palestinian youths away from joining the resistance against Israeli occupation and apartheid. The idea, according to this report, first came from the Israeli side, who suggested that only these things could take Palestinian youths away from their hostile fixation on Israel. Apparently, Israel tried broadcasting pornography from at least one television station in the southern West Bank, but had to pull back from its cultural offensive because of protests from Jewish settlers in the area, who felt that pornography materials on local screens could have a detrimental effect on the settler population. 700 years after Samson was blinded by the Philistines, at around the same time of Alaric's sack of Rome, when the empire tottered on the verge of collapse and Christians were being blamed, St. Augustine took the insights of Plato and combined them with those of the Hebrew scriptures to come up with a new formulation of the relationship between slavery and freedom. Unlike Aristotle, who argued that men were slaves phusei, which is to say by nature, Augustine took a radically moral view of the issue. Man was free as long as he acted according to the dictates of practical reason. It is clear, St. Augustine wrote in the City of God, that sin is the primary cause of servitude. That means, St. Augustine continued in another passage from the same book, that a good man, though a slave, is free, but a wicked man, though a king, is a slave. For he serves not one man alone, but what is worse, has as many masters as he has vices. What followed on the heels of St. Augustine's book looked like the collapse of the civilized world. In reality, the fall of Rome was another word for the birth of Europe out of the wreckage of classical culture. People like Saint Benedict of Nursia saved classical culture by providing, through the rule of Saint Benedict, a vehicle for the Christianization of the ravaging ethnic groups, which were then in the process of destroying the Roman Empire. All of history, according to St. Augustine, could be reduced to two options, symbolized by two cities. The city of God was based on love of God to the extinction of self. And the city of man was based on love of self to the extinction of God. If the city of God was based on love of neighbor and service, what is the city of man based on? It's based on the opposite of love and service, or to use St. Augustine's term and the title of my book, it is based on libido dominandi, the desire to dominate. The distinction I'm trying to make here is like the difference between Jesus Christ and Dracula. Jesus Christ shed his blood so that we can have eternal life. Dracula sheds your blood so that he can have eternal life. For 1,000 years following the fall of the Roman Empire, Christian Europe based its culture more and more effectively on Augustine's principles. That doesn't mean that no sins were committed in this part of the world for that millennium, but it does mean that an increasingly unified group of ethnic Christian communities made up Europe, had the right idea, the city of God, before them as their model. It also meant that they had the correct idea of freedom. The essence of freedom was reasonable, moral behavior. This meant that a man had as many masters as he had vices. Beginning in the 18th century, powerful forces began to emerge to challenge the medieval order established by the church. Once Europe turned away from the city of God, it had to turn to the city of man. That meant that libido dominandi became the constitution of Europe. And that meant that the history of the Enlightenment was more and more sophisticated forms of control. Augustine's statement that a man has as many masters as he has vices could also be interpreted as a form for control. In fact, once Christianity was repudiated, it had to be interpreted this way. The only alternative to the city of God is the city of man. And that meant that anyone who repudiated love of God and love of neighbor as the rule of life had to adopt the other rule, which is libido dominandi. Because of that fact, the history of the Enlightenment is nothing more than the development of more and more sophisticated technologies of control. The Enlightenment did not and could not create a new man. In order to seduce the old man, they had to go back to the very Christianity they sought to destroy. This explains the similarities between the writings of the Marquis de Sade and Saint Augustine. The statement, let me read this statement to you. The state of the moral man is one of tranquility and peace. The state of an immoral man is one of perpetual unrest. That statement sounds as if it had been written by Saint Augustine, but it was written by the Marquis de Sade. Both would agree with the statement's meaning. The difference is that Augustine was interested in promoting tranquility and peace, and the Marquis de Sade was interested in promoting the opposite, namely the perpetual unrest that went by the name of revolution. The Marquis de Sade understood that in order to create a revolution, you have to first subvert the morals of the people. By 1795, the French Revolution had created so much carnage that it was causing a reaction. The Catholics from the Vendée were marching on Paris. They were threatening to put an end to the revolution. To stop this counter-revolution, the Marquis de Sade wrote The Philosophy of the Bedroom. To get the population back to the most basic principles of revolutionary politics, how was he going to do this? Lycurgus and Solon, he wrote, fully convinced that immodesty's results are to keep the citizen in the immoral state indispensable to the mechanics of republican government, oblige girls to exhibit themselves naked in the theaters. The mechanics of republican government, in other words, depended upon the systematic arousal of passion. The only thing that prevented the Marquis de Sade from implementing his revolutionary views was technology. In order to arouse passion as a tool of revolutionary politics and control, the Marquis de Sade was limited by physical constraints, namely the number of men he could get into a theater to look at the naked women. These constraints would be lifted with the arrival of television, the motion picture, and the internet. They could now transmit images of naked women into every home that had a computer or a television. technology could now apply the same philosophy of control through manipulation of passion to unprecedented numbers of people. The goal, however, would remain the same. Sexual liberation has always been a form of control and was conceived of as such from the beginning by its major theoreticians, by the Marquis de Sade and roughly late, 150 years later, Wilhelm Reich. Wilhelm Reich is the man who created the term sexual revolution. Wilhelm Reich is also the father of sex education. Wilhelm Reich was a communist and a Freudian, and as such, his main opponent in Vienna during the 1930s was the Catholic Church. After years of trying in vain to debate the existence of God and getting nowhere in persuading people to become atheistic communists, Reich noticed a simple fact. If you change the sexual behavior of idealistic young Catholics in the direction of sexual liberation, especially masturbation, then the idea of God simply evaporated from their minds, and they defected from the Catholic Church, and the way to successful revolution was clear. Reich tells a story in his book, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, about a young girl who was in the habit of masturbating. She was in a demonstration for sexual liberation, and an older Austrian woman told her that she was going to go to hell if she continued to do this. At that point, she stopped masturbating. Reich counseled her to start masturbating again. And this is the conclusion he drew from that. The compulsion to pray disappeared when she was made aware of the origin of her fear. This awareness made it possible for her to masturbate again without feelings of guilt. This incident, he continued, is pregnant with meaning for sex economy, or his word for sex education. It shows how the mystical contagion of our youth could be prevented. Mystical contagion is his word for religion, and specifically the Catholic religion.
Exactly what I said.
The revolution which could bring about the overthrow of the political power of the Catholic Church in Austria was based not on debate, but behavior. And this is again a direct quote from the Mass Psychology of Fascism. We do not discuss the existence or non-existence of God. We merely eliminate the sexual repressions and dissolve the infantile ties to the parents. The inescapable conclusion of all this, Reich concludes, is that a clear sexual consciousness and natural regulation of sexual life, which is what he means by sex education, must foredoom every form of mysticism, which is to say religion. That, in other words, natural sexuality is the arch enemy of mystical religion. By getting people to act contrary to the church's teaching on sexual morals, Reich and his followers automatically limited the church's political influence, and this was the first step in the revolutionary takeover of Austrian society. That was true of Austria in the 1930s, and it's true of Poland today. The logical conclusion of this sex education project is clear. The total sexualization of a culture would mean the total extinction of the Catholic Church and the classical state based on the moral law. The process of the uprooting of mysticism, to use Reich's words, is accomplished more effectively, in other words, by deviant sexual behavior than by debate over the existence of God. The real purpose of sex education, of a contemporary Reichian play like the Vagina Monologues, the real purpose of the demonstrations of Pussy Riot in Russia or of Femen in the Ukraine, is to uproot the faith and the morals of the largely female population which go to see it by promoting masturbation and deviant sexual activity. Now, there's a problem here from Reich's point of view. Most people will not act out sexually in any consistent fashion on their own. They will be intimidated by social convention or inhibition and brought back to repentance. If women are inhibited sexually by the culture, changes in imagery promoted by the culture will bring about a change in behavior, which will in turn bring about a change in values. First, Reich needed to change the culture. He needed to produce what he called mass situations. Again, this is a quote from the psychology of mass fascism. The mass psychology of fascism. When I talk to a sexually inhibited woman in my office about her sexual needs, I am confronted with her entire moralistic apparatus. It is difficult for me to get through to her and convince her of anything. If, however, the same woman is exposed to a mass atmosphere, is present, for instance, at a rally at which sexual needs are discussed clearly and openly in medical and social terms, then she doesn't feel herself to be alone. Her individualistic, moralistic inhibition is offset by a collective atmosphere of sexual affirmation. Her sexual negation, because she herself has had similar thoughts when she was alone, is released secretly by this mass situation. The sexual need is given confidence by the mass situation. It assumes a socially accepted status. At the very moment that Reich wrote this, Hollywood was creating the mass situations that he was talking about. And what happened after that was a battle, a cultural war in the United States that began in the 1930s. America is like Yugoslavia.
Amerykę można porównać do Jugosławii.
It is made up of three ethnic groups that are based on three religions. In Yugoslavia, there are Serbs and Croats and Muslims. In America, we have Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. And as in Yugoslavia, these groups fight each other in America. And so what happened in the 1930s is basically the Catholic Church engaged in a battle with Hollywood over the sexualization of American culture. Hollywood was vulnerable because it had gone into debt to finance the technology for talking pictures in 1929. At this point, the Catholic Church acted. In 1933, Cardinal Doherty of Philadelphia declared a boycott of all Warner Brothers theaters in Philadelphia. One of Cardinal Doherty's associates was at a meeting in Hollywood, and he said, "Harry Warner is crying tears as big as horse turds because he's losing $100,000 a week in Philadelphia alone." And so Hollywood capitulated.
I nastąpiła tutaj kapitulacja ze strony Hollywoodu.
And the Catholic bishops imposed a code on Hollywood films. The Catholic bishops, in other words, imposed they took control of what Reich called the mass situations. And for 31 years, there was no nudity in films, there was no obscenity, there was no blasphemy, and no ridiculing of the clergy. And then in 1965, the Catholics lost their nerve. Pawnbroker, mm-hmm. Right? Which showed bare female breasts on the film, in theaters. At this point, the Catholic Church should have called for a boycott, but they didn't. They lost the culture war at this moment. There has never been a successful counter-sexual revolution, a counter-offensive against the sexual revolution since the collapse of the Legion of Decency. The Catholic Church lost the war on abortion. They lost the war on contraception, they lost the war on homosexuality, and now they just lost the war on gay marriage. The culture wars are over in America. The forces of the moral law have lost that war. All of the conservative movements that began under Ronald Reagan in 1980 have all failed. The battle is now in Poland. You have the opportunity to succeed where America failed. The counter-revolution against materialism began in Poland in 1979 when the Pope came here and had said mass in Warsaw at Victory Square. That counter-revolution was taken over by the neoconservatives in America and destroyed. But the possibilities are still open in Poland. Fighting sex education is a battle that was lost 20 years ago. It's not being fought in America. But the fact that it's being fought here and now is a sign that there are still possible, it's still possible to win that battle. Yeah. So once again, Poland is called upon to save the West. Jan Sobieski and the cavalry arrived in Vienna and saved the West. And now the new enemy is at the gates of Vienna. The new enemy is Wilhelm Reich and sex education.
Nowym wrogiem jest Wilhelm Reich i edukacja seksualna.
The world is looking at Poland to save the West once again. Dziękuję bardzo.
Dziękuję bardzo.
Poland has what America lacks. Poland has a unified ethnic Catholic culture. America had a Catholic culture in its ethnic neighborhoods, but that Catholic culture was destroyed by social engineering. So the only way that Catholics could unite with each other was not as Catholics, but as conservatives. And what happened over the 30 years after the Catholics voted for Reagan is that conservatism got redefined as support of capitalism, as support of Israel, the state of Israel, as support of war in the Middle East, and all of the promises about abortion and sexual liberation and defending the family were all forgotten. All of the evils that we're fighting here, these are great evils. Abortion is a great evil. It can only be dealt with spiritual weapons. It can't be solved with political solutions. The church is in possession of the weapons, the spiritual weapons that you need to defeat this evil. The church has to mobilize the Polish population with spiritual weapons because the evil that they're confronting is too great for the political process. The Poles, the Catholics, can only win this battle with solidarity. They have to stand together and fight together and not be divided by their enemies.
So the strength of Poland is predicated on the strength of Catholicism, and how do we maintain Orthodox Catholicism when we have so many enemies around us? We're doing everything to basically water it down, destroy it.
By solidarity, by sticking together. Which means we do not internalize the categories of our oppressors. We do not judge fellow Catholics according to foreign standards, according to the standards of our enemy, by foreign criteria like homophobia or psychological expertise or decrees from the European Union. We do not let this divide the solidarity of the Catholic Church. We reject this interference in our religious lives.
In your book, you paint a very sort of black picture of the future, a very grim picture of the future. But do you see any at least small signs of hope that things might be turning for the better?
Yes, I see signs of hope. The greatest sign of hope I saw is this year, in September. In 2003, I watched helplessly as the Israel lobby took over our foreign policy and launched America into wars in the Middle East that have now cost us $6 trillion. And it looked in September as if the same thing was going to happen again. There was a poison gas attack in Syria. It seemed like a false flag operation. It seemed as if America was now going to attack another country in the Middle East. And then the Pope Francis called for a day of prayer. And the course of history changed. 4 days later, Obama, President Obama, gave a speech, and at the beginning of the speech, it sounded as if there was going to be another war. But by the end of the speech, he deferred to Vladimir Putin and chose a peaceful solution. 6 weeks later, there was an agreement for the first time in 30 years between the Iranian government and the United States government. This is the type of spiritual resource that we Catholics can draw upon. This is when history started to move in 1979 against worldwide materialism. The Israel lobby is furious. Benjamin Netanyahu is furious. But history is on the move again, because God created space and he created time. And the human mind perceives time as history. And God is the Lord of history. And that means history has to have a good outcome. And this is precisely what Pope John Paul II said here in Warsaw in 1979. He told the Soviet communists, you can't exclude Christ from history. And that's why I'm optimistic about the situation right now.
When you look at the heroes of your book, like Marquis de Sade and the others, they were all basically degenerates. How is it that being the degenerates they were able to wield such great influence?
Because there's a fallen part of man. There's part of every one of us that wants to rebel against God's plan. And when these evil people seize the instruments of power, when they seize the power of government, these people are encouraged, and that leads to the collapse of the society that we've seen.
In essence, some of these evil people, well, they're elected by somebody, so we can say that there's a deficiency within the democratic liberal system that leads to these kinds of results.
John Adams, one of the founding fathers of America, addressed this problem. He described the limits of the political process when he said, we have no constitution that functions in the absence of the moral law. He said, those who break away from the moral law end up constructing their own chains. So he understood that democracy only functions if you have certain preconditions, some pre-political conditions, moral, metaphysical conditions in place.
You mention in your book that the revolution was associated in many ways with hatred of monarchy, because the king was the guarantor of stability, the guarantor of the faith to some degree. And do you think maybe we can even discuss the potential return to a monarchical system instead of the democratic system?
I think the political system is irrelevant. All political systems have their strengths and they all have their weaknesses. I don't have anything against monarchy. I don't think we're ever going to return to monarchy. Democracy has its flaws, it has its strength. I think what we're talking about here is beneath or before political arrangements. These are social arrangements that have to be guaranteed by a supernatural institution like the church. If the social order is guaranteed by the church, then democracy will function, or monarchy will function, or any type of government will function. If you undermine this moral foundation for society, nothing will function and everything will become a form of tyranny.
Liberation in your book, and right now there's a lot of kooks out there who are talking about liberating themselves from their own sex. Especially in the so-called mainstreaming of gender. And how does that relate to what you've written in your book?
Freedom has only meaning in terms of being. So a man is by definition a rational creature. So this means he only has freedom if he acts rationally. So if someone is proposing an irrational project, like denying that he is who he is, or sexually, or whatever other reason, it cannot possibly be any type of freedom or liberation. You're only free to be who you are. And if your behavior contradicts your nature, it cannot lead to freedom. It cannot be an expression of freedom. So homosexual behavior cannot be an expression of freedom, because it contradicts the nature of sexuality.
We're seeing right now that it's being pushed very hard in legislation and in law, and sometimes you can't even, for example, you can't get money from the World Bank if you're not pushing the gender ideology. So how, why is it so strongly manifested, especially in the world of politics today? And why are the why is the influence so large, in essence?
Because they're trying to control you. It's a form of control. That's the whole point of this. If the World Bank says you need, we will only give you money if you do something that contradicts what is good for Poland, then turn down the money. If anyone is proposing something that you know is wrong, anything that is contrary to reason, and homosexuality is contrary to reason, they are not promoting it for your good. They are promoting it to destroy you. The whole point of promoting homosexual marriage is to destroy your culture. That should be obvious.
Your book ends in 1992, so Bill Clinton is just elected president. But who would you add from that time up until today who contributed greatly to the escalation of the whole sexual revolution? Some heroes.
David Geffen.
Once again, David.
David Geffen, a Hollywood producer. He's the one who told Bill Clinton to put gays in the military, homosexuals in the military. The whole vagina monologues came after I wrote my book. That's a classic expression of Reichian subversion. And as I mentioned in my talk, Pussy Riot and Femin, they're classic Reichian examples of subversion, of sexual subversion. And in February, I was in Iran. I gave a talk on Hollywood in Iran, and I met with a minister in the Ministry of the Family. And she said that there are women who are telling her this story. The women go out in the morning, and there's a DVD on their doorstep. These are Iranian women in places like Tehran. And so she takes the DVD, she puts it in the computer, and it's pornography. This war, this culture war, is going on in Iran right now. Pornography is being used as a weapon against the Iranian people right now.
Organization is mentioned a lot in these questions that is promoting the sexual revolution. What other global organizations would you name that are at the forefront of this?
I was at the World Population Conference in Cairo in 1994. And a proposal was made to define abortion as reproductive health. And it was defeated by an alliance between the Vatican and Iran. When I got back from Iran in February, there was an article in the New York Times, and the headline of the article said, Axis of Evil. Who is this Axis of Evil, according to the New York Times?
Iran,
Russia,
Rossiya,
the Vatican.
I Vatican.
So to answer your question, every institution in the United States of any stature supports this agenda. It's not just the United Nations. It's every university supports it. Hollywood supports it. Goldman Sachs supports it. Every institution supports this. The only one left is the Catholic Church.
What inspired you to research the subject matter?
Bill Clinton. No, I'll give you a longer answer.
He must have been very inspired.
He was a very inspiring man.
Yes. Very inspiring.
I was, in 1979, I was hired as an assistant professor of American literature at St. Mary's College in South Bend, Indiana. 1 year later, I was fired for opposing abortion. And so I thought, there's something wrong with this picture. You should have fired me for being for abortion. But the feminists had taken over this institution. And so I decided to get out of academia and get into journalism. And for 20 years, I researched the sexual subversion of the United States. And that's how I wrote Libido Dominandi.
How do you convince people who aren't convinced yet, or people who are on the fringes of the church, or even inside the church, but don't have a comprehension or opposed to what you're writing? How do you get the message across to them?
Well, you have to explain the real story. Do you believe that sexual liberation is a form of political control? Well, then you can convince someone else. Once you explain it, it's easy to understand, isn't it?
Proste.
You don't have to be a genius to understand this. You don't have to be a genius to understand when the Israelis broadcast pornography to the Palestinians, they're not trying to bring liberation to the Palestinians. So use that example and see what people say when you say it.
You mentioned the boycott as a sort of form of positive coercion and influence. And we know, for example, that in Mexico, before the Cristeros uprising, there was a certain boycott of, I'm not sure what kind of products, but the Catholics, that's some sort of boycott. And how would you assess the possibility of influencing the culture through boycotts today?
In America, there's no possibility, because there's no solidarity in the Catholic Church in America. But Poland's a different situation. I don't know exactly whether it would work or not, but it's the better chance of having it work in Poland because there's more solidarity in the church than there is in America.
How would you define the forces that are behind this revolution? Are they more financial, ideological, or political?
It's a hierarchy. So at one point in American history, it was illegal to sell pornography. At a certain point, the ruling class elite in places like the Supreme Court decided that it was in their interest to allow the sale of pornography. And I can only assume that they came to this conclusion because of the reasoning that I expressed in my talk today.